Pass versus Frosted, Inc. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, no, okay, I just think it's probably fine. You think it should be lower?
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Matthew Duffy for the WAP appellants. Three questions resolve this appeal. First, when can it be said that WAP knew that it had a right to compel an application right applicable to these claims such that it could intentionally relinquish that right? Two, whether Doyle established a bright line rule such that any motion to dismiss waives a right to compel arbitration? And three, whether the district court's reading of the contractual jury waiver provision can be reconciled with its text, and in particular the words, or otherwise. I think starting with the first question, it's important to recognize whose terms are at issue here. This is not a case that involves WAP's terms of use with the consumer or a bilateral contract between the parties. These are LaunchPass's terms of use. And they're governing LaunchPass's own website and services. And that alleged use of the website and services is only one aspect of a much larger complaint. WAP's objective conduct before the district court's ruling in March of 2025 was of a party that did not believe itself to possess an arbitration right to the applicable claims, that it did not believe that the use of LaunchPass's services and website was related to the claims that are at issue here before the court. And thus, there was no arbitration right that WAP could exercise. The only time that WAP discussed the terms when it came to the motion to dismiss briefing, and you can see this in WAP's prior briefings before then, was to reference the terms as it related to the CFAA claim. The CFAA claim is excluded from arbitration expressly in the terms of use.
May I ask you, given the filing of the 12B6 motion to dismiss, which was granted in part and denied in part, if that had succeeded all across the board, would there have been anything left to arbitrate?
If that had succeeded across the board, no, I don't believe there would be anything to arbitrate.
How does that affect your argument that they didn't think that the litigation in which the 12B6 motion was brought pertained to the same matters as the arbitration? If total success on the 12B6 motion would have left there nothing to arbitrate.
Well, I think that the standard articulated in Doyle and just the common
sorry,
law, the standard articulated in Doyle
yeah.
and the common law standard in Morgan, you know, removed the prejudice requirement and said we have to focus on the conduct of who has the right, right? And it is did you intentionally relinquish a known right? So what we're saying here is that if the right wasn't known, right, even if you moved to dismiss the entire case, even if that was granted and then later it was discovered, oh, you had a right to arbitrate beforehand, the action could not be viewed as intentionally relinquishing a right that you did not know that you had. They would fly in the principles of common law waiver, as we understand it.
Oh, please.
You knew all along that your adversary was asserting violations of the terms of use, right?
Yes.
And I take it your position today is that you're not bound by the terms of use, that would be the position you would take on the terms of use claims, you know, throughout the litigation, right?
That we're not bound by
that. Because is your argument that your position was there's no contract binding us, the terms of use don't bind us, and therefore we didn't think we had an arbitration right?
No. I think our argument is that the terms of use and the use of LaunchPass's website and services, right, it's the terms are in connection with the terms or the use of any product or service provided by the company. Our understanding beforehand, and if you look back to WAP's prior submissions before the motion to dismiss, is that those relate to the CFAA claim, right? And that claim is excluded from arbitration. So it's that the right to arbitrate arises from the other claims, whether that is sort of expanded beyond the CFAA claim, which is excluded. And that analytical leap only occurred when the district court, for the first time in March 2025, said actually the use of LaunchPass's terms, the use of LaunchPass's services relate more broadly than the CFAA claim. It relates to unfair competition. It can be viewed more broadly as evidence of impropriety more broadly. Now, yes, we're going to contest the merits of that, but the scope of arbitration and the rule when it comes to arbitration is whether the claims touch on the factual claims touch on the arbitration right. And I think before then, it wasn't clear that it did. And after then, you know, we had disagreed beforehand, but if the court says that we believe these claims touch on it, then that's the court's opinion.
So I'm trying to understand your argument mm-hmm. is that it didn't occur to your client until 2 years after it was served with the complaint. And the court actually ruled on the motion to dismiss that your client had a right to arbitrate based on the complaint and the charges, the allegations of a complaint.
Yes.
Your client had the complaint.
We did. Right?
So are you saying that you weren't thinking about how you might respond to the complaint for 2 years?
We were thinking about how to respond to the complaint for 2 years, and we had a position of how we believed that we had an interpretation of what we thought the complaint was saying, and that's the way we had acted the entire time, whether there are allegations of the use of launch passes, use of products and services, and that those relate to the CFAA claim. That was our understanding moving forward the entire time. I think we sort of referenced in the motion to dismiss briefing frustration that we felt like the way the complaint was drafted was like Lego blocks. They were sort of being placed together in every way, shape, or form.
Or was it that you had new counsel after the complaint was the court ruled on the motion to dismiss? That new counsel looked at the complaint and thought, hey, we may have an arbitration claim here.
It wasn't that new counsel did come in after the motion to dismiss was decided, about 2 weeks, I believe. But it wasn't that we looked at the complaint, it's that we looked at the motion to dismiss ruling and the establishment by the court of what the complaint said, right?
I guess it's a weird posture.
Typically,
for your client to be in, typically what we see is the large entity, or corporation, company that includes a mandatory arbitration provision and their general subscription agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Is then sued
mm-hmm.
and says, hey, you agreed to go to arbitration when you subscribed. Here, it's a weird posture for the individual who subscribes to the agreement. And typically what we see is someone saying, hey, you know, I went online, I signed up for this, and I didn't, you know, understand that I would be required to go to arbitration. It seems an odd posture for your client to be in to say, I want my right to arbitration, to the arbitration that I didn't, you know, it's a unilateral agreement.
I think it is an odd factual posture, right, where you sort of have impropriety of our client being argued based on potentially violations of the terms of use of our opponent. I think that is unique. Right. Usually you're correct. It's an employment agreement that is known. There's no discussion here. And that's why I think knowledge is so important that, you know, yes.
Your claim then seems to be, hey, we had a right we didn't know existed until the court pointed something out in a ruling. Does that excuse your ability to raise that right at the time you're supposed to raise it? In other words, how can you say, do you have a case that says, hey, when I missed a defense I had, I, you know, should have the right to raise it because I missed it until the court pointed it out.
I'm at it. Do I have permission to answer the question?
Yes, okay. Let me answer the question.
I think there are cases. I think there's a case from the Third Circuit, Valley. And I think mostly in the context it comes up is more in the case of class actions where it's not clear whether the arbitration right is going to be applicable to the class. There was actually a case that came out just last Tuesday, Kelly v. Bolero, which involves sort of a similar posture. Again, it was, you know, a class action claim. There was an arbitration right. It wasn't a question of whether the arbitration clause existed, whether it could apply, but whether the right actually applied in that claim, whether it was going to be something that was going to be implicated in that claim. And they went through class, I think they went through the motion to dismiss process. And afterward, they said, okay, it does appear after the motion to dismiss process that the right, you know, is implicated in that claim. I'd say that's analogous here.
Can I ask, I mean, I appreciate the argument you're making. I think it's inventive. Doyle and the cases I've seen all seem to look at the conduct of the litigant right, like things like filing a motion to dismiss, other conduct in the case, as what is relevant to determining whether a waiver occurred. And you're not looking at your conduct. What you're describing, I'm not sure how we would get from the record. It's sort of an assertion about your client's mental state. So I guess my two pieces would be, how would we get that from the record instead of sort of what you're telling us about what your client knew? And is it consistent with Doyle and the, you know, our cases or the court's cases that address this to be thinking about it in terms of your mental state rather than looking at your conduct?
So I think that, ask the two questions. One, I think that looking at the content of what was done also counts as conduct, right? It's not just that we filed a motion to dismiss, it's what was filed. And that was true in Doyle as well. Doyle discussed the fact that they asked for Colorado River abstention as a type of thing that was done that could have removed something from the court. So the action was not just the filing itself, looking at all aspects, it was the content of what was put in the filing.
I'm not sure that I'm following that, because here you sought dismissal for failure to state a claim. I would think that would, had you succeeded, that would have been even more conclusive than an abstention ruling. I recognize the significance of Colorado River abstention, but it seems to me, if, as I suggested my first question to you, if you had succeeded, this would have been the end of the matter.
I think you're correct. If we had succeeded,
and so it
yes.
looks like, if that's all one knows, alluding to the record, as Judge Coven pointed out, it looks like you made a choice to try and win on a 12B6 motion. When that didn't completely succeed, now you're looking to get arbitration. And so where do we look in the record for some reason not to apply Doyle here?
Well, I think, again, intentional relinquishment of a knowing right requires knowing. And I think that what the motion to dismiss, although it did seek...
And what is there in the record that suggests that this action, contrary to the exercise of an arbitration right, was not intended to be a waiver? What is there in the record to suggest that? Because Doyle could be understood to say that it is a waiver, or at least it's presumptively a waiver. What do we look for?
I think we look, I mean, here I'm asking the court to look for knowledge, right? And if the knowledge didn't exist.
Where is it in the record that you adduced any evidence that you lacked that knowledge?
We never put in the record that we did have that knowledge, and our understanding in the record, I think it's pretty clear that we believe the terms and the website and the use of the services was related.
So is what you're looking for from us a ruling that filing a 12B6 motion and seeking complete dismissal of the case is not by itself evidence of a knowing waiver?
I don't think that that sort of bright line rule would track general waiver principles, because if it's a right...
Isn't that what Doyle suggests is either an actual waiver or at least a presumptive waiver that you would have to offer some evidence to overcome?
Doyle's footnote 10 does discuss that. And there's language in there that, you know, I think my opponent has pointed out regularly seems to indicate that. There's other language in there which says you have to look at all aspects of the party's conduct. And I think that there's key language in there that says, you know, what should we do with this standard now that Morgan has come down and disposed of prejudice? We already have a standard. It's whether there was intentional relinquishment of a known right. So I think that Doyle, if viewed as, you know, looking at every unique circumstance, and the difficulty in discovering whether there's been intentional relinquishment, because it does require knowing somewhat of what was in someone's mind, and we can only do that looking objectively at their conduct, requires looking at all aspects of the conduct of the party. And I think that Doyle was uniquely involving that party's conduct. You know, the agreement there wasn't the non-moving parties agreement. It was the UBS, their own client relationship agreement. They knew about it. They were aware of it. There was no dispute that it would sort of cover the claims here. That's different than what we have here, where there's specific conduct in, but not exclusive to, you know, not the entire complaint, that says that WAP, you know, used LaunchPass's website and services that was by WAP treated as a CFAA claim up until the motion to dismiss ruling, where the court said this is evidence of something beyond just the CFAA claim.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you all today. My name is Fred Schreiber. I represent the appellee and plaintiff SlackPass. I want to try to answer the most recent question first, which is this idea that knowledge has to dictate the application of a standard. Certainly not Doyle or any other cases that applied that have suggested that part of the inquiry is to conduct a subjective analysis of the moving party's state of mind at the time it elected to proceed with litigation to determine whether it understood subjectively whether it could have asserted a right to
arbitration. It is a basic principle of waiver law that a waiver has to be knowing. Do you disagree with that?
Your Honor, that's a good question. I think that the analysis turns on what was within the possession of the movement's knowledge at the time the complaint was filed. In other words, the movements here had a complaint that clearly referenced the terms, clearly stated that their conduct violated the terms.
I may not be making myself clear. I thought you were urging that Doyle suggests that acting inconsistently with the arbitration rights, specifically by asking for full relief from the district court.
That's correct.
Gives rise, that allows the court to imply that there's a knowing waiver.
Absolutely.
But I don't think it suggests that a waiver doesn't require that it be knowing. I mean, it's just that kind of action implies knowing waiver.
Correct.
Do you disagree with that?
I agree with that.
So we're not talking about waiver being recognized in the absence of knowledge.
Correct, Your Honor. Again, just to this point, the complaint in this case clearly asserted a violation of the terms of service. When movements moved to compel arbitration, they argued very specifically, unequivocally, that the complaint was clear that all the claims are subject to arbitration. It was only after the court disagreed with the motion to dismiss, however, that they filed that motion to compel. Just to step back, I think to what I think how the appeal actually is to be resolved. We think this is an easy case. It starts and ends with Doyle. Doyle articulates the proper standard governing waiver after the Morgan decision issued by the Supreme Court. And Doyle articulated the standard as follows. Did the movement knowingly relinquish the right to arbitrate by acting inconsistently with that right? Applying that standard, in this case, this court and Doyle held that a party knowingly relinquishes its right to arbitrate by affirmatively seeking a resolution of the dispute in the district court, including by filing a motion to dismiss. The court in Doyle specifically explained that by filing their motion to dismiss the case against them in their entirety, the movements intentionally availed themselves of the district court's authority and sought that affirmative relief. That action is inconsistent with the right to arbitrate. And the court also—
Let's say there were a different set of facts where a litigant genuinely doesn't know that they have an arbitration right. There's the contract is ambiguous in some way. The litigant has a good faith belief that the arbitration right doesn't exist. In that case, do you think if the litigant files a motion to dismiss that they've waived their arbitration right?
Yeah, good question. I think my answer is two-part. Number one, I don't think that's the case here. But number two, to your question, I think what the analysis focuses on is, again, what information was available to the movement. In other words, if the movement had a copy of the agreement, in this case, the terms of service, had a complaint that specifically referenced the terms of service, it is no excuse for the movement then to say, well, I just didn't put two and two together. That's why it only occurred to me 2 years after the litigation commenced that we actually can also move to
If that's the case, is this really a waiver doctrine in terms of like intentional relinquishment of a known right? Because in that case, the movement doesn't know about the right and they have not intentionally relinquished it, right? They just maybe should have known about it. So it feels like not waiver, but something else.
I think, again, in my perspective in that case, which is not the case here, a party is charged with party has the information necessary to assert its rights. If it chooses not to assert them, I don't think the court looks to see, well, whether in that specific circumstance, that party buried its head in the sand to later say, or new counsel to say, we actually have this other argument we want to raise. And Doyle very specifically, again, focuses on this issue of did the party seek affirmative relief? And the Doyle court, importantly, made clear that it doesn't matter that in that case, the movement sought to dismiss on the basis of Colorado River. It said in footnote 10, of course, likewise, a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim will also preclude a later motion to compel arbitration. Moreover, I think the court explained in footnote 11 that a motion to dismiss is not necessary to find waiver. Other conduct by a litigant could be sufficient to establish an intentional relinquishment of that right. However, the court explained that motion to dismiss was sufficient. And in that case, the court explicitly said, we're not going to look at the other conduct of the litigants because we think the motion to dismiss is itself sufficient to constitute waiver. The district court in this case faithfully articulated and followed that standard. It said what we need to look at is whether the movements engage in conduct that constitute a knowing relinquishment of their right to arbitrate. Applying that standard, the court in this case concluded that they did. They acted inconsistently with their right when they filed a motion to dismiss all of Slack Pass's claims with prejudices and on the merits for failure to state a claim. And the court explained the motion sought to resolve the entire case before it. In doing that, the movements made a binary choice to litigate, to ask affirmative relief from the court. The court spent months analyzing those arguments, issued a 37-page opinion analyzing legal sufficiency of those claims, and denied in large part the motion. It was only
What other conduct you said, you know, Doyle deals with the motion to dismiss. What other conduct, and I know that in this case, the court focused on the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, but is there other conduct in this case that you point to that shows that reflects a waiver, knowing waiver?
That's a great question. And Doyle did not go past the motion to dismiss. It said, that's enough. The court in this case went through that same analysis, said that's enough. And then the district court actually went further and said, in addition, there is other conduct by the defendants that evinces an intentional relinquishment. And that is that they waited 2 years before they even raised the possibility of arbitration after the complaint was filed. During those 2 years, they actively engaged in the litigation, not once mentioning that arbitration may apply until after the motion to dismiss was denied. That included filing the motion to dismiss. That included submitting a joint discovery plan. Answering the complaint with affirmative counterclaims. In fact, there was motions practice early in the case where there was a motion for preliminary injunction filed that was subsequently withdrawn.
Right, the first 4 months, 2.5 months, we're dealing with the motion, your client's motion for a preliminary injunction, which it subsequently withdrew.
Correct. And the defendants opposed that preliminary injunctive and the expedited discovery relief. Not once at that point did they say, hey, wait a minute, these should all be in arbitration. Then they filed a pre-motion letter stating their intention to dismiss the complaint, conferred with our client, with us on behalf of our client. We filed an amended complaint. No aspect of those discussions ever included mentioned by defendants that there's an arbitration clause here and that governs at least some of the claims.
Can I ask, maybe you can respond to one of your adversary's arguments. So let's just assume that there is a knowing requirement, okay? And so that, and your adversary is making arguments about whether the record suggests they had knowledge of this arbitration right or not. And your adversary, I don't want to cast his argument incorrectly, but he says, if you look at what was going on, it was really the motion to dismiss decision that put us on notice of this arbitration right. And before that, I think he's suggesting we thought this was really a CFAA dispute, it's only the motion to dismiss decision that put us on notice that there are claims here that aren't subject to the arbitration. Can you respond to that piece? We're looking to the record to assess knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the problem with that argument is it's inconsistent with the record. Number one, again, when the defendants moved to compel arbitration, they didn't focus on the motion to dismiss. They said very clearly, and we say in our brief, the complaint here clearly states claims that are all subject to the arbitration clause. There was no equivocation. There was no reservation of any kind. So at that point, there was no confusion. Number two.
Are you referring now, and I'm going to ask your adversary to address it to the 17th affirmative defense that they put into their answer, which is plaintiff's claims are barred in whole or in part by the arbitration clause contained in LaunchPass's terms of use? I mean, that was pled as an affirmative defense, and I'm finding it a little hard to see how they're saying they didn't know that they had a right to arbitrate the claim when they say that all of the claims were barred by arbitration.
I think the timeline of that, just to make the timeline clear, they filed that answer after the motion to dismiss was denied in large part. So the motion to dismiss is denied.
I see.
Then they get an extension. Then they file an answer.
I see.
Then we spend 2-3 months starting the discovery process. And in fact, both parties exchanged discovery requests after that the motion to compel arbitration was filed.
I see. Thank you for clarifying
Thank you.
That.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Duffy, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you so much. So I think two things I want to just bring attention to with my adversary's argument. First is it does really feel like he's advocating for a bright line rule, that if Doyle is fully sufficient, that you can move to dismiss, even if you are not aware that you have a right to arbitrate, that that would be sufficient to do it. Or second, what I think I heard was the negligence rule, right? Really the idea that this was in the complaint, and yes, even though that the terms and it only, you know, the terms did come up in the complaint, but it was only referenced in the CFAA claim, even though, right, it was not entirely clear, and you said this in your motion to dismiss, that you were not entirely clear where this relates to with the other claims. Even though you said all that, you should have known. And that's a negligence standard. Right, and I pulled out Deng v. Frequency Electronics, but it's citing another case, Herrera v. Mana, right, and it's discussing sort of the overall principles of waiver and the importance of the fact that it's not a negligence standard, right? Mere silence, oversight, or thoughtlessness in failing to object is insufficient to support an inference of waiver. I mean, I think there's a possibility here that WAP was, you know, could have potentially done more, but I think at most that's negligence, and that cannot show intentional relinquishment of a known right.
Let me ask you.
Yes, of course.
I was just quickly relooking at the district court opinion. Mm-hmm. And in addition to saying that you brought the 12B6 motion, the district court did make other findings about conduct that it thought was inconsistent with ignorance about waiver. What did you put before the district court to support that you were genuinely unaware of this? Was there an attorney affidavit? Was there anything to suggest that there wasn't actual knowledge? I ask this because it seems to me it's a question of fact, and if you're arguing that the district court erred in finding that you knowingly waived, I'd like to see what in the record supported a contrary conclusion.
So we didn't put an affidavit is because, you know, I think that unlike where this is a place where we didn't know the terms existed, you know, it's not necessarily a question of fact. It's a question of law, whether the
knowledge, what you knew and whether that would cast a different light on your filing this motion, it seems to me might very well involve questions of fact.
When we drafted the motion, we said that, you know, we, in our motion to compel arbitration, our very first one, we said that we did not waive the right because the district court's opinion allowed us to clarify exactly that. Sort of I can pull it up right on me, but we did say that, like, you know, the district court opinion allowed us to clarify whether we had the right to compel arbitration in these matters. And thus, right, it was not waiver that we waited until afterwards. We didn't submit an affidavit, I think, saying to that extent, but we did submit, you know, we submitted briefs that we attested to that said this is our legal understanding of what's going on.
I'm sorry, that said what?
The briefs, and the briefs are our real opinion of what our understanding of the claims were.
Me that Doyle suggests that filing a dispositive motion like the 12B6 motion you filed gives rise to at least a presumption that you're knowingly waiving the right to arbitration?
I think that footnote 10 gives rise to that presumption, but I...
All right, so now you're urging the court not to apply that to your client. What did you say to the district court distinguished your case from Doyle?
Sorry, could you say that again?
What did you tell the district court distinguished your case from Doyle?
So we said that the motion to dismiss that we had done it was a way for us to clarify the claims and get an understanding of sort of what was arbitratable and what wasn't. That's what we said was different, that the not all 12B6 motions are bright line rules that could waive the right to arbitrate. But that this one, this our specific motion to dismiss, that's what our understanding of.
So you told the district court you filed the Rule 12b-6 to clarify what was arbitrable?
Yes, we.
So you knew you had a right to arbitrate, and you thought, I mean, that response suggests that you thought some of these claims could indeed be arbitrable.
We argued that we did it to clarify the factual claims, not the arbitrability of claims. We did it to clarify, again, our difficulty in understanding the complaint, as many different pieces put together, wasn't sure which claims fit, which factual allegations fit with each claim. We did say that in the motion to dismiss briefing.
You never told the district court, we didn't realize we had a right to arbitrate until we read your ruling on the motion to dismiss.
I don't think we said it with those words.
Thank you to both counsel. We will take a reserved decision on the matter. Thank you both.